WILL programs are made possible with support from The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377. Open 7 days a week for lunch and dinner.
Farmers in the Southeast have accused their own food cooperative, the Dairy Farmers of America, of striking a deal that created a milk monopoly and has dragged down the price of raw milk. In settling this case, the cooperative said it did nothing wrong. Peggy Lowe of member station KCUR in Kansas City reports.
Farmer Sam Gelfand says this lawsuit should inspire a John Grisham novel. More than 7,000 dairy farmers in southeastern states say they were betrayed by their own representative, called the Dairy Farmers of America, Incorporated, the largest milk marketer in the U.S. They allege the cooperative created a cartel, cutting out competition, and forcing farmers to take lower prices from the only available milk processor. Gelfand says while cooperative executives were living the high life, he watched while farmers went out of business.
When I started in North Carolina, there were 1,200 dairies. Today, there are less than 300. In South Carolina, there were 800 dairies. Today, there are less than 100. That's not just consolidation.
Farmers had hoped that a trial would expose all the cooperative's dealings, but yesterday, a day before that trial was to start in Tennessee, Dairy Farmers of America CEO Rick Smith announced that his group would pay nearly $159 million to settle the case so long as it could maintain it did nothing wrong.
Where inherently there's risk when you go to trial, the members' interests would be better served by making a business decision to put it behind us.
Dairy Farmers of America faces a similar suit from northeastern dairy farmers who say for years that they, too, have been victims of a monopoly that manipulated milk prices. For NPR News, I'm Peggy Lowe.
Lots of communities across America rely on skiing for their economic well-being, and at mountain resorts across the country, an abundance of natural snow also means that more skiers and riders are getting lost in the woods. And they have to be rescued, which takes money and resources. As Vermont Public Radio's Nina Keck reports, the issue over who should pay for these rescues can be kind of tricky.
Snowboarders at Killington check out an expert run near the summit. These folks are not the troublemakers. No, this story is about other skiers and riders, the ones who go looking for fun in all the wrong places. Bob Gelito is a former Killington ski patroller who's now on the state police.
It's almost moguled up. You see all the ski tracks. There's high volume of people coming through here.
Gelito is pointing to an unmarked trail into the woods that eventually leads to a clearing. But it's not like you can stumble onto this. There's a bright orange rope you have to duck under and several big signs that say, out of bounds, no skiing beyond this point. Despite all that, Gelito says an alarming number of ill-equipped skiers keep going.
Now, if I'm looking out there, I'm like, wow, that looks like some powder. I'm going to ski that. So they're going to head downhill. And as they go down, the trees get closer and tighter, and then they're in a problem.
Because this part of the ridgeline drops off fast and leads far away from any lifts. Within a few hours, these backcountry wannabes are exhausted, cold, and in the dark. Gelito and Vermont State Police Captain Donald Patch believe more skier education is needed. But how best to provide that remains unclear. In the meantime, Patch says the cost to taxpayers for so many search and rescues is troubling.
When the trooper is tied up on a lost skier case, that's time that they're not following up on their other investigations.
Vermont is one of a handful of states that allows billing for some rescues. But for a state that depends on skiing and tourism, it's controversial and for safety reasons rarely used. Neil Van Dyke heads Stowe Mountain Rescue and is a past president of the Mountain Rescue Association.
As search and rescuers, we feel very strongly that there should never be any disincentive for somebody to call for help when they need it.
He says there have been documented cases in Colorado where people in trouble have put off calling for help because they were afraid of getting billed. But not everyone agrees with that.
When people get in trouble, they don't hesitate to call. They call immediately because they are in trouble.
Kevin Jordan helps run New Hampshire's search and rescue program, which frequently handles rescues in the White Mountains, notorious for severe weather. They've been less squeamish about billing when they believe those rescued are being reckless or negligent. While Jordan says the policy has stirred up debate, he doesn't think it's deterred anyone from seeking help.
What I did notice is when we conduct the mission, as we're getting this person down, a conversation now is generated, am I going to get a bill? And that's the only difference I've seen. I've seen no effect to tourism.
But many people simply can't pay. He says they've collected only about two-thirds of the $83,000 they've billed in the last 5 years. And that's just a fraction of the roughly $1.5 million New Hampshire spent on all rescues during that time.
It's a very hot debate in the state because people have very strong feelings about it. But the problem is that on Monday, the bills have to be paid. And when we're not buying equipment and we don't have a training budget and we're sending guys up above tree line in January in 60 below weather, we have a responsibility to ensure their safety. And so we're walking a dangerous tightrope.
It's an issue many states are struggling with. In Wyoming, a state lawmaker pointed out that demand for search and rescue there hasn't necessarily increased. But he says more funding is needed because those who seek help are taking bigger chances and in more dangerous situations. For NPR News, I'm Nina Keck in Chittenden, Vermont.
Late January is often called the dry spell for many sports writers. The Super Bowl isn't until February the 3rd, and aside from some recent breaking scandals like Lance Armstrong's doping admission last week, there's not a lot happening in the world of sports. Commentator Frank DeFord says that's why we should give our sports writers a break this week.
Sports fans are jealous of sports writers because it's a dream job or you get paid to watch games, which is above all what sports fans want. Once upon a time, this was true. The sports writers watched games, keeping score meticulously, and then wrote it all up so that the poor devils who had real jobs could read about the games. Well, that's the way it was. But today, there are no news cycles. News is like the Earth going around the sun, cycling constantly. As a consequence, sports writers are required to update and blog and react to everything. Press box visitors are astonished to see that sports writers, of all people, do not have time to watch the game because they have to forever file something or other for the endless cycle. So now it is the sports fans at home with their gargantuan HD TVs who are the privileged ones watching the games while sports writers are the ones not able to. Now that's a fine how do you do, isn't it? To save themselves from extinction, ace sports writers have become specialized. It used to be that the star newspaper columnists were generalists, churning out homely anecdotes about humble heroes. But now sports writers are experts in specific sports. The champion model is Peter King of Sports Illustrated, who was just voted Sports Writer of the Year. He is amazing. Every NFL week, he writes an internet column, Monday Morning Quarterback, that runs for literally thousands of words. You can't stop him. Imagine Scheherazade with statistics. Peter King not only critiques all the stars of all the games, but also arcane things like offensive linemen and special teams coaches with authority. It would be as if each and every Paul Krugman economics column also included deep inside skinny on the Department of Agriculture or the National Institutes of Health. So in the mold of the celebrity Mr. King, do other specialist sports writers analyze? But you see, this is the most trying time of the year because there is no game this week. So we have this interminable countdown to the Super Bowl, and each day is worse for sports writers because there is nothing new to analyze. And this year, everything besides the Super Bowl is also so depressing. A smarmy Lance Armstrong comes out of the woodwork. The magnificent Stan the Man and the gentleman, Stan Musial, dies. And that gloriously original genius, Earl Weaver. So too gorgeous Gussie Moran, who at a time when we still could be shocked in sports, wore the most famous athletic underpants ever. Plus, there's going to be a movie about Joe Paterno starring Al Pacino. Please, if there is one thing we don't need, a Joe Paterno movie. So fans, be kind. I've dubbed this Be Sympathetic to Sports Writers Week, the black hole on our sports calendar.
Frank DeFord is a sports commentator for NPR based in Connecticut.
Support comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, with beginner-level instruction in Iyengar yoga and special classes for men, women, teens, seniors, and for those with or recovering from cancer. New classes start the first week of February. Details at yoga-cu.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday, the 23rd of January, 2013. It's the birthday of the French writer Stendhal, born Marie-Henri Bayle in Grenoble in 1783. He used more than 100 pseudonyms, but he's most famous as Stendhal, and it was as Stendhal that he wrote the two novels that we know him for, Le Rouge et Le Noir, The Red and the Black, and La Chartreuse de Parme, The Charterhouse of Parma. It's the birthday of the Irish novelist J.G. Farrell, James Gordon Farrell, born in Liverpool, 1935. Went off to Oxford, contracted polio, had to spend a long time in an iron lung so he could breathe, which was the basis of his second novel, The Lung, a comedy about a hero stricken by polio who has a craving for alcohol and women. J.G. Farrell, best known for a trilogy of novels about the waning of the British Empire. Troubles, published in 1970, The Siege of Krishnapur, 1973, and The Singapore Grip, 1978. He was 50,000 words into another historical novel when he drowned at the age of 44 fishing off the west coast of Ireland. It's the birthday of the poet John Logan, born Red Oak, Iowa, 1923, author of The Zigzag Walk and other collections, who wrote in his poem, Believe It, there is a strawberry that grew out of a carrot plant, a blade of grass that lanced through a thick rock, a cornstalk 19 feet 2 inches tall, grown by George Osborne of Salome, Arkansas. There is something grotesque growing in me, I cannot tell. It's the birthday of the poet Derek Walcott, born on St. Lucia in the Caribbean, 1930, grew up reading Wordsworth, John Milton, Andrew Marvel, got a scholarship to study in Jamaica, then to study theater in the United States, then went back home and founded the Trinidad Theater Workshop. Taught at Boston University, became friends with Robert Lowell, and in 1990 published his epic poem Omeros, a retelling of Homer's Odyssey, set on St. Lucia. Derek Walcott, who said, I come from a place that likes grandeur. It likes large gestures. It is not inhibited by flourish. It is a society of physical performance. It is a society of style. I grew up in a place in which, if you learned poetry, you shouted it out. Boys would scream it out and perform it and flourish it. If you wanted to approximate that thunder or that power of speech, it couldn't be done by a little modest voice in which you muttered something to someone else. I come out of that society of the huge gesture, and literature is like that.